We're looking then this morning at the life of John Wycliffe and John Huss, and I'm just going to work through them each in turn, chronologically, beginning with Wycliffe, and then probably this afternoon we'll start looking at Huss. First of all then, we look at the life of Wycliffe, and at the beginning of the pictures there are two of the most well-known portraits of Wycliffe that you might just care to glance at. That seems to be at least something of what he looked like as far as we know. Wycliffe was born, well, we're not quite sure where, and we're not quite sure when. Modern scholarship tends towards 1330, roughly, as the date of his birth. Now, the place is more tricky. The 16th century writer, John Leland, who lived in the reign of Henry VIII, tells us that Wycliffe was born at Spreswell, a mile from Richmond in Yorkshire. But rather confusingly, Leland also tells us that Wycliffe came from the village of Wycliffe on the River Tees, some 10 miles from Richmond. Now, historians have struggled to reconcile these statements. And it's made even trickier by the fact that there is actually no such place as Spreswell, a mile from Richmond. So to solve this enigma, some have suggested that Spreswell is a typographical error for Ipswell, or Hipswell, a village that does indeed exist quite close to Richmond. And that seems to be a reasonable solution. As to the connection with the village of Wycliffe, it's been argued that this was the ancestral seat of the Wycliffe family, John Wycliffe's family, even though he himself wasn't born there. And certainly, a family named Wycliffe had been lords of the manor there ever since the Norman conquest. There's no hard evidence to prove that John Wycliffe did belong to this Norman family that shared his name, but many historians accept the likelihood that he did. So without getting into the details of this complex debate, I think we can be reasonably content to accept that Wycliffe was a Yorkshireman, that he was probably born at Ipswell, or Hipswell, and that he probably belonged to the Wycliffe family that ruled the village of Wycliffe on the River Tees. And that immediately brings us to another mystery. We're not sure how to spell Wycliffe's name. One German scholar classified 30 variations. Normally, one of two spellings is opted for, either W-Y-C-L-I-F, or W-Y-C-L-I-F-F-E. Both are well attested, and both are found in the textbooks. It rather looks as if in Wycliffe's own day, his name may have been pronounced Wycleave, because his enemies referred to him as Dr. Wicked Believe. So, obviously, you have to get some kind of rhyme there. Well, Wycliffe, the man of mystery then, when was he born? Where was he born? How do you spell his name? How do you pronounce his name? He continues to be mysterious in his early life, about which we know almost nothing. At some point, he went to Oxford University, probably Balliol College, where he trained for the priesthood. Wycliffe spent almost all his time at Oxford University, both learning and teaching. And mostly he was based in Queen's College from 1863 onwards. By 1866, he was a Bachelor of Divinity, and in 1872, he became a Doctor of Divinity. He held a number of livings in the church. He was Rector of Fillingham, Ludgers Hall, and Lutterworth. But until the end of his career, he left these parishes in the care of a curate so that he could devote himself to scholarly pursuits. And certainly Wycliffe seems to have felt very much at home in Oxford University. During his last days at Lutterworth, he once burst forth into a nostalgic song of praise for the landscape of Oxford, its woods and river, which shows how much he appreciated its natural beauty. Unfortunately, we know little of Wycliffe's activities in Oxford before his involvement in politics in around 1370, by which time he already had a reputation as an outstanding thinker. How he achieved that reputation and the development of his ideas prior to 1370 are all part of the mystery of John Wycliffe. One thing, though, is clear from the testimony of his contemporaries. Wycliffe became Oxford's most celebrated philosopher and theologian. And since Oxford University was one of Europe's greatest intellectual institutions at that time, that says a lot for Wycliffe. And it also explains why the papacy took it so seriously when a man of Wycliffe's stature, the greatest intellectual of one of Europe's greatest universities, began criticizing the doctrines and practices of the medieval church. Criticism from such a source could not be ignored. In today's terms, I suppose it would be rather as if, in one of America's greatest universities, a teacher of political science who was world famous for his writings and acknowledged talents embarked on a radical crusade against the American president and his staff and their policies, subjecting them to regular and withering criticism as betrayers of America and the American Constitution. The effect and the resonance which that might have today gives us some feeling for how Wycliffe's critique of the papacy and the institutional church was received in his day. We may, however, be surprised to find Wycliffe as a great philosopher, as well as a great theologian. Why would a great evangelical reformer and preacher be a philosopher? So perhaps a word of explanation will be useful. In our society today, theology and philosophy have to a great extent gone their separate ways. Most philosophers are not theologians. Most theologians are not philosophers. And that's largely due to the increasing gulf between, on the one hand, our society's understanding of itself, and on the other hand, the Christian faith. And when that happens, when you get that kind of gulf, philosophy and theology are bound to diverge. Now, philosophy in one shape or another has been an accepted branch of human culture in the Western world since the great days of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle in Athens, the intellectual capital of Greece in the centuries before Christ. So, when a society abandons Christianity as its public faith, the great cultural pursuit known as philosophy, it becomes increasingly the province of non-Christian ideas and systems of thought. But it was not so in Wycliffe's day. The situation was quite different then. Whatever problems we may have with the official Christianity of 14th century Europe, and Wycliffe himself was to have very serious problems, as we'll see, that should not allow us to miss the basic fact that Christianity, not secular humanism, not the New Age, not Islam, but Christianity was the official public faith of European society at that time. The culture of Wycliffe's day understood itself through the medium of fundamental Christian beliefs about God and the world and human destiny. Now, that being the case, philosophy in 14th century Europe was something that was pursued within the larger setting of a Christian view of life. And in fact, so much was this the case that our distinction between philosophy and theology didn't really exist in Wycliffe's day. Generally speaking, the two subjects blended and mingled and merged with each other. The great philosophers were theologians, and the great theologians were philosophers. The real difference between philosophy and theology in those days was that philosophy was more concerned with what could be discovered and understood through human reason, whereas theology was more concerned with what could be known only through divine revelation, as that revelation was to be found in the scriptures and in the teaching of the church. But both philosophy and theology were done by men who, like Wycliffe, professed the Christian faith. And from within a Christian view of life and the universe and everything. And philosophy and theology impacted on each other, much as today the different sciences impact on each other. You can't keep the sciences in watertight compartments. Physics, chemistry, biology, they all act and react on each other. And it was the same in medieval Europe with philosophy and theology, so that it would not necessarily have been very easy to see where the one ended and the other began. Wycliffe, therefore, would have seen himself and been seen as a Christian thinker, whether he was dealing with philosophy or whether he was dealing with theology. I hope that helps us to understand why Wycliffe was a famous philosopher. Now, the kind of theology that Wycliffe would have studied and taught at Oxford University was what is called scholastic theology. Scholastic theology. And scholastic simply comes from the word school. It was just another way of describing a university in the Middle Ages. So, scholastic theology really means university theology, as it was practiced in medieval Europe. A scholastic theologian was also called a schoolman. Now, as well as being theologians, the schoolmen were, as I've said, also the philosophers of the Middle Ages. They wanted to give a comprehensive account, not just of the teaching of the church, but of all truth. So they did not limit themselves to theological questions. They would try to answer deep philosophical questions too. What is matter? What is mind? What is time? What is space? What is being? What is the nature of cause and effect? And so on. Wycliffe was thoroughly steeped in this way of thinking, and he gave his own answers to some of these questions. He didn't see this as useless philosophical speculation. He regarded it as part and parcel of his duty as a Christian thinker to tackle the basic questions of existence. Well, now let's ask ourselves who the main people might have been who influenced the younger Wycliffe in the formative period before he rose to national and international fame in around the year 1370. Now, among figures from Wycliffe's distant past, I realise Wycliffe himself is in the distant past as far as we are concerned, but the figures from Wycliffe's own distant past, the one who influenced him the most was undoubtedly Augustine of Hippo, the early church father of the 5th century. This isn't the place to retell the story of Augustine. Maybe we'll do that on a future occasion. But suffice it to say that one of Augustine's most enduring legacies to the Western medieval church was his hugely influential exploration of God's sovereignty in the salvation of sinners. Augustine hammered this out in his long controversy with Pelagius and his followers, who denied the doctrine of original sin and upheld human free will as the decisive factor in salvation. So when the word Augustinian is used in theology, and when I use the word later on, it generally refers to a belief that divine grace is unconditional and sovereign in the predestination and salvation of sinful human beings. Augustinian. Now, perhaps the word that would most readily spring to our lips would be Calvinist. But of course, Augustine got there first, 1,000 years before Calvin. And Calvin regarded himself as nothing other than a humble disciple of Augustine. Well, Wycliffe too falls into that same category. It's very interesting and significant that the theology of Augustine underwent something of a renaissance in the last 2 centuries of the medieval period. Various thinkers reacted against the teachings of the great English scholastic theologian William of Ockham. Ockham's theology was seen by many as little better than Pelagianism, and his critics set forth a renewed Augustinianism as the answer to Ockham. And Wycliffe stands very much in that stream of Augustinian Renaissance. And in that way, as in others, he foreshadowed the Reformation teaching of Luther and Calvin. So there's Augustine then, the greatest influence on Wycliffe from Wycliffe's own remote past. One great English medieval figure who it is thought may have influenced Wycliffe was Robert Grosseteste. His dates are 1168 to 1253. Robert Grosseteste, usually remembered today as a pioneer scientist. His name, incidentally, means big head. Grosseteste, which may not endear him to us, Robert Bighead. But if Grosseteste was big-headed, it was more in the greatness of his mind than the greatness of his ego. We don't know much about Grosseteste's early life, but in 1235 he became Bishop of Lincoln, and that was the English bishopric with the largest territory. Here, Grosseteste devoted himself to reforming life and conduct among clergy and people alike. He especially insisted on the clergy's duty to preach the scriptures and the people's duty to come and listen to the word of God. Grosseteste himself was a great preacher, and he preached in English, not Latin. So determined was he to bring the gospel to ordinary, uneducated people. The work of a priest, he proclaimed, is not giving people the mass, but preaching the living truth. Grosseteste's zeal for reforming the church catapulted him into a long and bitter conflict with the papacy. He protested passionately against Pope Innocent IV's appointment of spiritually unfit Italian friends and relatives, even little boys, to money-making positions in the English church. And Grosseteste's disgust at the corruptions of the papal court provoked him into explosions of prophet-like condemnation. He accused Pope Innocent IV of being an antichrist and predicted his eternal damnation in the hereafter. Now, Grosseteste enjoyed such a universal reputation for holiness and for intellectual brilliance that Pope Innocent dared not discipline him for these outbursts. But when Grosseteste died, Innocent proclaimed, "I rejoice, and let every true son of the Roman Church rejoice with me that my great enemy is removed." Well, obviously, Grosseteste's dates, dying 80 years before Wycliffe was born, rule out the possibility that he had any direct personal influence on Wycliffe. But Wycliffe can hardly have been unaware of his great reforming predecessor. And some historians have felt that Wycliffe may well have been encouraged by the example of Grosseteste as a reformer and as a critic of the papacy. It's also interesting that Wycliffe embraced the same view as Grosseteste about the relative merits of preaching and the sacraments. Certainly, as far as English evangelicals were concerned, Gross the Test came to be seen as a precursor of John Wycliffe, and ultimately of English Protestantism, owing to Gross the Test's commitment to biblical preaching and his outspoken opposition to a corrupt papacy. Also, the life of a man like Gross the Test does remind us, I think, to be cautious about taking an overly pessimistic view of the medieval church. There were men like Gross the Test around. So Gross the Test is another possible influence, then, on Wycliffe. Now, quite often in Protestant literature, the young Wycliffe is said to have been a disciple of Archbishop Bradwardine, Thomas Bradwardine, and his dates are 1290 to 1349. Now, Bradwardine was a professor of theology at Oxford University, chaplain to King Edward III, and briefly Archbishop of Canterbury for 40 days in 1349 before dying of the plague. Now, he published a very important book in 1344 entitled Concerning the Cause of God Against Pelagius. The book reveals Bradwardine as one of the medieval church's greatest Augustinian theologians, expounding and defending Augustine's doctrine of the sovereignty of divine grace in human salvation. It earned Bradwardine the nickname the Profound Teacher. And it reminds us yet again that we ought to resist the temptation to paint the medieval church in totally dark colours, as though all truth was lost until a Wycliffe or a Luther came along. If a man like Bradwardine, whom the hymn writer Augustus Toplady regarded as the greatest English theologian of all time, could rise to become Archbishop of Canterbury, it seems clear that for all its faults and defects, the medieval church was still capable of providing a home for great and godly minds. What about Bradwardine's influence, then, on Wycliffe? Well, certainly Wycliffe's own theology has a striking affinity to that of Bradwardine. Like the Archbishop, Wycliffe, too, was to be a zealous believer in the sovereignty of grace. However, while it may be true that Wycliffe owed a lot theologically to Bradwardine, there's no evidence that he ever studied personally under the great Archbishop. It seems more likely that any influence of Bradwardine on Wycliffe was through Bradwardine's writings rather than direct personal contact. So Augustine, Gross the Test, Bradwardine, and then finally there's the figure of Richard Fitzralph. And his dates are 1295 to 1360, and he was the Archbishop of Armagh. Now, Fitzralph was both a scholastic theologian and a noted preacher who, in the year 1332, became Chancellor of Oxford University. He was deeply committed to the advancement of learning among the clergy. And in Fitzralph's case, we know for a fact that he did influence Wycliffe. There's no speculation here. Towards the end of his life, Fitzralph became involved in controversy against the friars. Chiefly, these were the Franciscans and the Dominicans. And his bone of contention with them was their practice of begging for a living. He condemned this as contrary to the teaching of Christ. He formulated his views in a treatise concerning the salvation of the poor, in which he set forth his views about voluntary poverty, possession of property, lordship, and the state of grace. And these views, we know, had a profound impact on Wycliffe. Wycliffe took them up and reproduced them vigorously in his own conflict with the institutional church. So those are some of the actual or possible influences then on Wycliffe in his formative years. That brings us now to Wycliffe's emergence onto the stage of national and international affairs. Sometime in the 1360s or thereabouts, the late 1360s this would be, Wycliffe became a religious advisor to the court of the English King Edward III. There's a portrait of a stone effigy of Edward III in the handouts there. Edward III's date, 1327 to 1377. Now, this seems to have been because Wycliffe had developed theological views which the English monarchy and the English nobility found very useful in their political conflict with the papacy. This conflict revolved around the papacy's claim to own England. Now, such a claim may seem preposterous to us, but it was based on the fact that King John had indeed surrendered England to the Pope, Pope Innocent III, in the year 1213, in return for being restored to the Pope's favour after a long-running dispute which almost cost John his throne. Now, 150 years later, King Edward and his nobles contested keenly John's right to do what he had done. They argued that John had had no right to place the kingdom under tribute to a foreign power without the consent of the whole kingdom expressed in Parliament, and that had not been forthcoming. The Parliament of 1366, accordingly, refused the demand of Pope Urban V for back payment of England's tribute to the papacy, which was now 33 years overdue. Alas, the mystery factor strikes again at this point. There seems no agreement among historians whether it was in 1366 that Wycliffe was launched into his career as a political celebrity, or whether it was 8 years later, in 1374. Whichever date it was in the context of this struggle between England and the papacy that Wycliffe made his first contribution on the national scene. He wrote a treatise on the subject, in which he gives a report of speeches of a number of English nobles against the Pope's demand for tribute. In the summer of 1374, Wycliffe went to Bruges as a member of a royal commission to negotiate peace with France. This was the period of the so-called Hundred Years' War between England and France from 1337 to 1453, and also, at the same time, to negotiate with the papacy on problems affecting the English church. And it's while Wycliffe is in Bruges that we first find him associated with the great English noble John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, younger son of King Edward III and younger brother of Edward the Black Prince. I couldn't find a portrait of John of Gaunt, but that's Edward III, the Black Prince. Well, it's an effigy of him in Canterbury Cathedral. So John of Gaunt is his younger brother. Now, John of Gaunt is a very important figure in English history. As well as playing a significant part as a warrior in the Hundred Years' War, he was one of the most powerful politicians in England, and his son, Henry, would in fact seize the English throne in 1399 as King Henry IV, the first monarch of the House of Lancaster. John of Gaunt was also the patron of the great poet Geoffrey Chaucer. In 1376, the growing resentment against the wealth and corruption of the English church hierarchy boiled over in the Parliament of that year, known as the Good Parliament. There seems during this period to have been a widespread hostility among Englishmen to the higher ranks of the clergy. Ordinary priests, friars and lay people alike denounced them as corrupt, greedy and immoral. English writers of this time, such as Geoffrey Chaucer, And William Langland, who wrote the poem Piers the Ploughman, certainly paint a rather unedifying picture of English church life in general. Wycliffe was fully involved in the agitation against abuses in the church. One chronicler of this particular period portrays Wycliffe as running about from place to place, barking against the church. John of Gaunt headed up a movement to confiscate the property of the church. And Wycliffe provided John with a doctrinal theory to justify this. So let's have a look at his theory. Based at least partly on his studies of Archbishop FitzRalph, Wycliffe put forward a doctrine of dominion or lordship. God, he argued, is the only source of true authority. God has delegated a portion of his authority over secular things to the state and over spiritual things to the church. However, human rulers can exercise this delegated authority only on condition that they faithfully serve God, the true Lord, who has delegated this authority to them. If they don't serve God, they lose their right to lordship. Now, this may seem a doctrine calculated to incite revolution, with the oppressed taking up arms to overthrow all political authorities that are held to be oppressive. Wycliffe didn't intend that. Indeed, in the secular realm, he counseled submission to existing authority. However, he was more of a revolutionary in applying his theory to the church. If bishops fail, he said, to live pure and blameless lives, then the state, which has dominion over secular things, is entitled to strip them of their property and their possessions. This idea appealed very strongly to the English nobility, who were only too eager to seize the vast wealth and property of the English church, especially when the church was deemed to be corrupt. Now, such dangerous ideas from the internationally famous lecturer of Oxford University could not be left unchallenged. So, acting on behalf of the church, Bishop Courtney of London summoned Wycliffe to appear before his tribunal at St. Paul's in London in February 1377 to answer for his views. But the protection of John of Gaunt prevented Courtney from harming Wycliffe. In fact, the tribunal witnessed a ferocious quarrel between John of Gaunt and Bishop Courtney. At the opening of the tribunal, the question arose as to whether Wycliffe should stand up or be seated. The Lord Marshal of England, Percy, told Wycliffe to sit down. Courtney protested, and John of Gaunt lost his temper, declaring that he would bring down Courtney's pride and the pride of all the bishops of England. "Do your best, sir," Courtney retorted. The proceedings degenerated into uproar, and John of Gaunt, who had outraged a good number of people with his vulgar disrespect for the bishop, was forced to retire, taking Wycliffe with him. In this unseemly way, the case against Wycliffe collapsed. The pressures on Wycliffe, however, increased in May 1377, because in that month, Pope Gregory XI summoned the Oxford lecturer to appear in Rome within 30 days, charged with no fewer than 19 deadly errors. Wycliffe, however, refused to go. Political events in England had propelled his protector, John of Gaunt, into a temporary position of supremacy. King Edward III died in June 1377, and his young grandson, Richard II, the son of the deceased Black Prince, succeeded to the throne, aged only 10. And there's a portrait in stone there of Richard II in his adulthood. But he was only 10 when he succeeded to the throne. So with the new king, not yet even a teenager, John of Gaunt became the most powerful man in the kingdom. So Wycliffe was safe. when Archbishop Sudbury of Canterbury tried to put Wycliffe on trial in January 1378, a mob of London citizens who supported Wycliffe broke up the meeting. The theology tutors at Oxford also supported Wycliffe. They declared to be true the 19 propositions that Pope Gregory XI had extracted from Wycliffe's writings as erroneous. In March 1378, Pope Gregory XI died, and the attempt of the cardinals to elect a new pope became a catastrophic fiasco, and it worked in Wycliffe's favour. Maybe this is the appropriate point to pause. So we'll have our first break. Is it for tea? It's not. It's just a break. Right. We'll have our first break then at that point. And